Welcome to our exploration into the source material. Today, we are diving into 12th century Spain, specifically looking at the military orders in Castile between 1150 and 1330, based on the research of Samzino Conodera.
Yeah, it is a really fascinating era. Our main mission here is to, you know, sort of debunk this popular myth of the warrior monk.
Right, the warrior monk.
Exactly. We want to understand what Conodera calls the ecclesiastical knight.
Because, I mean, the idea of a high-ranking Catholic brother who goes home to his wife and kids completely shatters our expectations of the Middle Ages, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the term warrior monk is actually a contradiction. Monks flee the world to find God, but these guys, well, they charged right into the bloodiest parts of it.
So they were knights first.
Right. Knighthood was what they called a prior form, so it dictated how they adapted monastic rules, not the other way around.
Wait, so it is kind of like a high-performance athlete adopting a monk-like diet and sleep schedule. Like, the goal isn't spiritual enlightenment. It is just to be a more lethal competitor.
Yeah, that is a great way to put it. St. Bernard of Clairvaux wrote this famous text, De laud nove militiae, and it was really a rhetorical tool.
Like a tool for PR.
Well, more for reforming knighthood. He was trying to take the malice out of the fighting class, not literally invent fighting monks.
Okay, but if they were prioritizing their identity as knights, I have to push back on the whole marriage thing. How did the Order of Santiago get a pass on celibacy?
Yeah, it seems crazy, but it was a calculated concession. Santiago had this unique concept of conjugal chastity.
Conjugal chastity. That almost sounds made up.
I know, right? But they were actually the only Catholic order allowing marriage. They knew lay knights would never abandon their duty to produce heirs.
So it kept the Castilian nobles engaged in the Reconquista without losing their family line.
Exactly. It was secular flexibility, which made Santiago way more attractive than, say, the Calatrava order, which had strict Cistercian ties.
But there was a catch, right? Like, during Advent and Lent, they had to live completely apart from their wives?
Yeah, the wives would actually pack up and move into specialized female convents.
Oh, like Santa Eufemia de Cazuelos.
You got it. So there was still discipline, just, you know, adapted for their reality.
Okay, so beyond the battlefield, how do they justify all their massive tax exemptions? They had a mission in the world, right?
They did. They framed fighting as perfect charity.
Like the verse from John, laying down one's life for his friends.
Exactly. The rule of Santiago literally argued that defending a Christian from capture was the same as feeding the hungry.
Wow. I mean, that is a wild reframing of charity.
It really is. And they backed it up by building these massive hospitals in Toledo and Las Tiendas.
And the ransom hospitals too, right?
Yeah. Places like Cuenca and Alcarcón. They were specifically dedicated to buying back Christian captives from the Moors.
So their wealth actually funded this international hostage negotiation.
Right. But, you know, eventually all that wealth and power caused a shift. The religious fervor started to fade.
Yeah, into just plain aristocratic pride. Like, by the 14th century, Master Alonso Meléndez de Guzmán gives this huge speech. And he doesn't even mention religious duty.
No, he just talks about the glory of his Guzmán line.
Just fighting for his family's honor.
Exactly. The focus shifted from the defense of the cross to just lineage and royal politics. The orders moved completely to the margins of the economy of grace.
Which makes sense when you see the royal interference. I mean, King Alfonso XII appointed his 11-year-old son, Fadrique, as master of Santiago.
Yeah, you don't appoint a child for his piety.
Right, you do it to control castles and cash.
Exactly. They became tools of royal and noble power.
So basically, they were knights who used the church to sanctify their lifestyle. But eventually, the institution just became a family piggy bank.
That is pretty much the trajectory, yeah.
It really makes you wonder, you know, if the Guzmán shift shows that personal legacy will always eventually eclipse institutional ideals, can any consecrated organization actually survive the pull of family and social status? Something for you all to think about. Thanks for joining our exploration today.